The last chapter, which was the first one of this current unit, was a survey of prokaryotes, right? How the first cells came into existence and how they then diversified. Now we're going to have a similar chapter that surveys the eukaryotes of the world, which of course came much later. We see actually one of each on this first slide. The one that's colorized brown is a eukaryote, and the teal colored one is a prokaryotic cell. But the reason it's in this chapter for eukaryotes is because only a eukaryote could do what's happening here. Notice that this brown cell, the eukaryote, is engulfing a cell that's as big as itself. And that's without a mouth or any opening, right? It's just folding around it, basically. And that's why I said that only a eukaryote could do this. Because to undergo such a drastic change in shape for a cell requires a very complex cytoskeleton, which you hopefully remember studying from 181, a system of three major kinds of proteins, right? Microtubules, microfilaments, and intermediate filaments. Does this ring a bell? Cytoskeleton in eukaryotes is much more complex and therefore allows for the complex interactions between those proteins required for a drastic change in shape. Bacterial cells, or archaeal cells for that matter, prokaryotes, whatever shape they have as a cell, it pretty much stays that shape. So that's just one fact about eukaryotic cells of many that's different from prokaryotes. But remember I said that it's not the prokaryotes' claim to fame that they have a huge variety of form, right? There's really three basic shapes of prokaryotic cells. Their claim to fame was their biochemistry, remember I said. Well, when it comes to variety of forms, or in other words, different shaped cells, it's not only a eukaryotic claim to fame, but specifically it's the claim to fame of the protists, which is really where the hell are my pens? Mostly what we're talking about in this chapter. Protists. You gotta be kidding me. Oh, here are some. Protists are eukaryotes. All protists are eukaryotes. But not all eukaryotes are protists. Well, the chapter is about eukaryotes in general, but we're going to focus on the eukaryotes that are not protists. This chapter is mostly about the protists. And I know I haven't told you exactly yet what a protist is. I'll get there, though. Anyway, protists have the most complex shaped cells of all living things. So that's kind of one of their claims to fame. In the second slide, we're looking at a timeline. Now, the smaller timeline, smaller in size, timeline at the top, that is the entire Earth's history. Notice it goes back 4.6 billion years. That's the whole age of the planet, right? Which is even longer than the age of life, right? Because there's a billion years before we got the first living cells. But it's put there for reference to show you that the entire history of eukaryotes is really less than half of the overall age of life. We've already said this before, right? There were over a billion years of life before we even got the simplest first eukaryotes on the scene. Prokaryotes were the only things around for a long time. But the colored part of it, which is expanded here for most of the chart, is the history of eukaryotes. And there are three colors, as you see on the timeline, that are not the same length, by the way. Notice that the years are given, the estimates. But that's because if you think of eukaryotic history as a whole, it's kind of has occurred in three major eras. And I don't mean era geologically. There's a geological time span. It's called an era. I just mean era in general terms. And these are denoted by different colors on the timeline. So first, you have really just the emergence. This first major period is the emergence of eukaryotes. They came into existence. They evolved. And that's about 1.8 billion years ago. We know it's at least that long because we even have fossilized remains. This is a 1.8 billion year old fossil of a very early eukaryote. So we don't know the exact date, of course, but it's at least 1.8 billion years ago. That's about where we put the beginning of eukaryotes. Now, they came into existence, which is an important event, of course. But during this first of these three periods, there was speciation, so there was some diversification, but not a hell of a lot. And they all were unicellular, as you would expect for the beginnings of things, right? You don't just immediately have a multicellular eukaryote pop into existence. They started out as unicellular cells or organisms. The middle period can really be thought of as the age of novelties. Important new things came into evolution, or evolved in this middle period, roughly 1.3 billion years ago to till a little over half a billion years ago. And remember, this is in the oceans where this is happening. There are various novel structures, and you can see some pictures of, you know, things are starting to look more complex. And there was also some multicellularity, although these are, you can't really tell from the pictures, these are still not very big organisms. So there was some multicellularity, but still a lot of unicellularity and everything pretty much small, as far as eukaryotes are concerned. Among these novelties that evolved, though, importantly, are photosynthesis, eukaryotic photosynthesis, I should say, and eukaryotic cellular respiration. Now, keep in mind what we've already gone through. Both of those really important processes, cellular respiration and photosynthesis, had already been invented, so to speak, or evolved in prokaryotes. But eukaryotes do their own versions, right, in specialized membrane-bounded organelles. Well, this came to the forefront in this middle part of eukaryotic history. And then the most recent one, which we're still living in, 600 million years ago, roughly till now, this can be thought of as the age of hugeness, because here's where we finally have very large organisms. It's also when the familiar groups that familiar to us nowadays came into existence. Plants, animals, and fungi, they didn't exist until 600 million years ago, roughly. And they are all much bigger than the vast majority of organisms that have ever existed. So that's where we are now. We're obviously animals, and that's part of the third era. When we go to slide 3, this is a cartoon depiction of what we call the endosymbiotic theory. It's actually, the slide is about more than this, but the endosymbiotic theory is an explanation for how important membrane-bounded organelles came into existence, specifically mitochondria and chloroplasts. But actually, that's I don't want to start with that because there's something else happening here that's important before we even get to that. In the upper left, you have a cell that is not a eukaryote, but it's it's an ancestor to all eukaryotes. This is the very beginning of eukaryotes as a group. Now remember the fundamental difference between a eukaryote and a prokaryote. What is it? I mean, there are multiple differences, but what's a big, huge difference between a prokaryote and a eukaryote? That's right, a prokaryotic cell does not have any membrane-bounded organelles, including the nucleus, but also other things as well, right? Whereas a eukaryote does. So the question is, how does evolution bring about cells that have membrane-bounded organelles, including a nucleus? Well, we can see this happening as we transition from that first cell in the picture to the next one. That first one, though, which is not a eukaryote, is an ancestral prokaryote that is most likely an anaerobic archaean. So remember that prokaryotes are spread out over two domains, right? There are archaea and bacteria. And also remember what we've already said about the tree of life, right? Even though archaea and bacteria are fellow prokaryotes, they are not actually closely related to each other as much as archaea are related to us, right? And we are eukaryotes. Well, here's this, you know, the molecular evidence for this is why we suspect pretty good certainty that the cell that became the first eukaryote was an archaean, and specifically an archaean living in anaerobic lifestyle. Now, anaerobic means without oxygen, right? The opposite of aerobic. So this is not only an archaean prokaryote, our ancestor, but also one that was not capable of cellular respiration. Just lived anaerobic lifestyle, going around eating things. Okay? Now, because of mutations, like mutations happen all the time, creating new traits, there started to be invagination or infolding of the plasma membrane. That's what you see in this second picture. And so this is still just one membrane, right? It's just a more elaborate membrane because it folds in on itself. And if it folds in on itself in such a way that in from different directions around the cell, so that those infoldings approach the nucleoid. Remember that in a prokaryote, the region where the DNA is called the nucleoid. It's not a true nucleus because it doesn't have a membrane. But it's the place in the cytoplasm where the DNA is. If these infoldings approach that, like you see in the cartoon, and then continue to elaborate or fold even more, then the DNA can suddenly be surrounded by membrane. And if that happens from different directions and they start fusing together, these different in-pocketings, then you officially have a true nucleus because it's its own membrane at that point. Now, what's especially nice about having it happen this way is that it agrees with the observation that not only is a nucleus of any eukaryote a membrane-bounded organelle, but it's an example of a multiply membrane-bounded organelle, because the nuclear envelope, which is the name for the membrane around the nucleus, is actually two membranes layers thick, which is exactly what you would get in this scenario, right? Notice how it's folded so that there's actually two layers. So that explains that very nicely. And also, what do we have here that's continuous with the nuclear envelope? What is all this stuff? Endoplasmic reticulum, which you'll notice even on modern cells, is a network of folded membranes, with that membrane being actually continuous with the outer membrane of the nuclear envelope. Here and there on a nucleus of a modern cell, the outer membrane of the nuclear envelope will fold out and become part of the membrane of the endoplasmic reticulum. So you officially now have a eukaryote. As soon as you have a true nucleus, which is membrane bounded, that's enough to make it a eukaryote, right? But you also, in the deal, get endoplasmic reticulum and eventually Golgi for the same reason, Golgi complex or Golgi apparatus. All right, so that's how we got the first eukaryotes to begin with. But this is still, now that it's officially a eukaryote at this point, but it's still living a lifestyle just like the cell that turned into it. It's a eukaryote, but it is still anaerobic. This explains, though, why when you look at when you compare cells molecularly, we eukaryotes are very similar to archaeans, because it was an archaean that this happened in. All right? Not a bacterium, in other words. Okay, now the rest of it has to do with or explains the endosymbiotic theory. An endosymbiotic is simply the adjective form of endosymbiosis, right? What is endosymbiosis? We talked about it. What does endo mean? Yes, it means inside, but I can't hear you unless you speak loudly. So be a little more lively. Endo means inside. What about bio? Life, sim, together, osis. Osis means condition. So endosymbiosis is the condition of living together. But specifically, one living inside the other. That's the endo part of it. And, you know, the reason we talked about this already is because we had the example of the headlight fish, I guess it was, wasn't it? Where the bacteria are living inside, the luminescent bacteria are living inside the pocket under the eye of the headlight fish. Okay, well, this is called the endosymbiotic theory for the evolution of mitochondria and chloroplasts, because it's almost certain that this is how things happened. You already have a eukaryotic ancestor now. It's officially a eukaryote, right? It's anaerobic, though. Now, so it's going around eating things as a unicellular anaerobic eukaryote. And it's easiest, of course, to eat smaller things, which would be bacteria, for instance. Bacteria are pretty small cells. And, you know, when you eat a bacterium, you digest it, just like we digest our food. We break it down and use it as fuel and raw materials to build things. Obviously, that kills the bacterium. That's how things happen usually. What the endosymbiotic theory says is that somewhere along the line, for whatever reason, one of these engulfed bacteria survived that process. Got engulfed by one of these early eukaryotic cells, but did not get killed and digested in the process. Instead, continued living inside the eukaryotic cell. Now, this wasn't just a bacterium. This happened to be an aerobic bacterium. In other words, one of these bacteria that were doing what bacteria had already invented, cellular respiration, right? And so, when this happened, the aerobic bacterium survived being engulfed by the eukaryote, the anaerobic eukaryote, it continued to undergo respiration inside the eukaryotic cell. And that became the first mitochondrion. Now, there are several lines of evidence that really make it very little doubt that this is what happened. Pretty convincing bits of evidence. One is that mitochondria they look like bacteria, for one thing, just just in their shape. Also, recall from 181 that just like the nucleus, a mitochondrion has two membranes, right? An outer and an inner membrane. Well, if you engulf a bacterium with its own membrane, you are wrapping part of your membrane around it, right? And forming a vesicle that contains it. So the membrane that the vesicle is made out of, which is your membrane, is now the outer membrane, and the bacterium's original membrane is the inner membrane. It doesn't just work out well that way. There are actually molecular differences between the two membranes of a mitochondrion, even today. And the inner membrane is very similar to a bacterial membrane. The outer membrane is more similar to a eukaryotic membrane. Even more convincing is that in addition to having two membranes, a mitochondrion, even today, has its own DNA, separate from the DNA in the nucleus of the cell. And not only that, but the DNA in a mitochondrion is arranged in a circular chromosome, just like a bacterium's own DNA, you know, that's living on its own. It also has its own ribosomes, just like bacteria do. They need ribosomes to produce their own proteins from the genes that are on their chromosomes, right? You find those in mitochondria as well. And those ribosomes, by the way, which, you know, any ribosome consists of large and small subunits, but the large and small subunits in bacteria are a little bit different molecularly compared to the ribosomes in eukaryotes, and that's true for the mitochondria as well. And also, mitochondria are able to reproduce themselves within the cell. They split into two using binary fission to produce two new mitochondria. Well, that's how bacteria reproduce, by binary fission splitting into two new bacteria. So there's really very little doubt that this is, you know, that doesn't say why it happened, why there was a survival of this engulfing process, but it's not hard to imagine that it could happen. Anyway, that is, when that happened, now you already had a eukaryote. Now you have a eukaryote that is aerobic because it's able to perform cellular respiration just like the bacterium was able to do on its own. All right? And that is the ancestor to us, because our own cells have mitochondria. They do not have chloroplasts. All right? So that happened first. Engulfing of aerobic bacteria to produce the first mitochondria happened before the first chloroplast. But that eventually happened. So now we have the cell right here, which is just like this one that's the ancestor to us. It already had mitochondria because of the engulfing of the aerobic bacteria. And, you know, I'm sure this didn't happen just once, but it's possible for it to only have happened once, because once it happened successfully, then the children, so to speak, the daughter cells that it turns into will have those features as well. Anyway, this one already has mitochondria. And then the same thing happens again, meaning that someone survives being engulfed again, except this time what survives it is a bacterium that is photosynthetic, which already existed, like I said, right? Way before there were eukaryotes, there were photosynthetic bacteria. And when this one survives, that becomes the first chloroplast. And everything that I told you that is convincing evidence about mitochondria coming about this way is also true for chloroplasts. They have multiple membranes, which is consistent with them being surrounded by the engulfing cell. They have their own DNA. It's circular. They have their own ribosomes. It's similar to bacterial ribosomes. So all of that applies to the chloroplast as well, but it happened later. And therefore, you have these two major forks shown in this picture. This one, in which only the one event happened, is our ancestor, which is why we have mitochondria but not chloroplasts. The other one, in which both of them happen one at a time, is the ancestor to all the photosynthetic eukaryotes, all the plants and all the algae, which are the two major kinds of photosynthetic eukaryotes. So that is the endosymbiotic theory. In slide 4, we're still talking about engulfing here, but the main point of this slide is that in some eukaryotic cells, we have plastids. A chloroplast is just one example of a general structure called a plastid. Not all plastids are chloroplasts, but chloroplasts are an example of a plastid. Anyway, in some species, we have plastids that have three or more membranes, not just the two that you would predict from being engulfed by a bigger cell. But it's still explainable in terms of engulfing. It's just that it's, if I get engulfed by something that's bigger, I will be a plastid in that first one with two membranes, right? And then if that thing that engulfs me gets engulfed by something even bigger, that's going to build up layers of membrane every time that happens, right? That's serial engulfing, basically. And we call that secondary endosymbiosis as opposed to just the primary that happened first. Primary builds up a layer, and then if that thing gets engulfed by something else, this brown one in the figure, then you have plastids that have three or more layers. Slide 5. Collection of green cells that are officially considered individuals. So this is not an organism, this is many organisms. Each cell is an organism. But that's a bit of a word game, really, because it's just us artificially trying to pigeonhole things. There isn't a perfectly clear-cut division between unicellularity and multicellularity. But I think I mentioned before that the only organisms that we consider to be truly multicellular are eukaryotes. Although, importantly, there still are plenty of examples of unicellular eukaryotes. The point is of this slide is that the transition to multicellularity was gradual. The first thing to evolve is a colonial lifestyle. And that's what we have here. These are algal cells. Individuals, each cell is an individual, but they live a colonial lifestyle because it benefits the population to be connected together. And then once you have that in place and the advantages that it has, then other mutations can bring about great more evolution to a truly multicellular lifestyle. Now the difference, by the way, you might say, what about this is not multicellular? Well, like I said, it's kind of a word game, but usually we define true multicellularity as having different kinds of cells producing performing different functions for the entire collection of cells that we call the organism. Here, these are all basically doing the same thing. They just happen to be connected together. So it's colonial, definitely, and then true multicellularity evolved from a colonial lineage. Slide 6, kind of shows you this in phylogenetic tree form. At the top, we have an alga that lives a fully free-living lifestyle, solitary. Every individual cell is just doing its own thing, doesn't care what the others are doing. These are all relatives, of course. On the bottom, you have Volvox, which is what we just looked at in the previous slide. And it is getting closer and closer to being truly multicellular, right? But by looking at the different lineages here, you can see that it's a gradual transition evolutionarily. Seven. is a tree as well, but in this tree we are looking at animals for one lineage, as you see, and most of the detail about animals will be in its own chapter. So that's what I meant earlier when I said, even though this technically is about all eukaryotes, we're going to focus on everything except everything that's a protist. Animals are not protists, but they're here because they're important eukaryotic group. And what we see here are also, I mean, what we see here is another lineage called coanoflagellates. Those are not animals. This lineage, which of course divides many, many times, that is the entire animal tree. In other words, animals is a true clade. What's another name for a clade? No, it's a type of taxon. What kind of taxon is called a clade? Remember the three types of taxa based on their trees, based on what's included? Another name for a clade is a monophyletic taxon. And do you remember what the definition is? What has to be true for a taxon to be monophyletic? Yes, it includes the ancestor to everything in the group, and it includes all of that ancestor's descendants, so everything that branches from it. That's true for animals. It's a true clade, monophyletic. But what do we call the situation we have here with coanoflagellates? What is the relationship between animals and coanoflagellates based on how they're arranged in the tree? They are sister taxa, exactly. So, phylogenetically, animals are closely related to coanoflagellates. Coanoflagellates are not animals, they're the sister taxon. But they're sister taxa by definition because they are two lineages that spring from the same node, right? That's where they separated and from the ancestor that's common to both of us. This ancestor at this node is the animal ancestor and also the coanoflagellate ancestor. And there are different lines of evidence pointing to this hypothesis. Remember, every tree is a hypothesis, and they get redrawn all the time as we get new data. But there's compelling evidence for putting coanoflagellates as a sister taxa to animals. For one thing, if you look at the basal taxon to animals, the ones that are closest to the original ancestral animal, those are the sponges, by the way. And sponges have, like all animals, not only multiple cells, but multiple different kinds of cells. If you look at one of these kinds of cells in isolation, called a collar cell or coanocyte, coana, by the way, means collar, same root as in coanoflagellates. But anyway, if you isolate one of these coanocytes from a sponge and just treat it like its own cell, which it is, and compare it to an individual coanoflagellate, which is a unicellular organism, that cell is the whole thing for a coanoflagellate. Here the cell is just part of a sponge. But they look almost indistinguishable morphologically. So that alone is pretty good evidence. But there's also DNA evidence that's really compelling. And the big difference here in lifestyle is that coanoflagellates are not multicellular, they're unicellular. All animals, I don't think there's any exceptions to this, are multicellular. So that is a kind of a fundamental difference between these two sister taxa. Well, in slide 8, we can see part of the reason why this occurred. So this is once again a tree showing coanoflagellates and animals. Now, some example animals are shown here, not all of them, of course. Hydra, fruit fly, and mouse are some representative animals. But these things that look like strings of beads represent proteins. And proteins, of course, are polymers made out of amino acids, right? They're large, complex molecules. And for proteins, shape is everything, right? That whatever the function is for a given protein, it has that function because it has that shape. And when you consider the overall three-dimensional shape of a protein, there are certain parts, not the entire molecule, but parts of the molecule sticking out here and there that are really important to its function, and we call those domains, protein domains. It's not a single amino acid, it's some sequence within the overall sequence. So it's just part of a protein. Anyway, that's what's meant by the word domain. And this CCD domain, which is the red bead here, that exists in animals, in the proteins that they make. And proteins, remember, are able to be produced by cells. They correspond to the instructions for how to build them, right, which are the DNA. So genetically, these are similar lineages, quinoflagellates and animals. But they're not identical genes. They're just similar genes. And one of the major events mutationally that happened in the animal lineage but didn't happen in the coanoflagellate sister taxon is the mutations that led to this part of the proteins called the CCD domain. And the reason that explains multicellularity versus unicellularity is that this CCD domain is important. It allows proteins that have it to stick together. It's important in cell-to-cell adhesion, which is an important component of being a multicellular organism, right? The cells, if you're going to be multicellular, your cells need to be able to be held together. And that's possible by the CCD domain. The coanoflagellates didn't undergo that mutation, so they remained free-living, solitary, unicellular individuals. Now we get to 9, which obviously is another tree to look at, but this tree is the entire domain eukarya. So this is much bigger than the animal one we've been looking at. Animals is just this little lineage right here. This is all of eukaryotes. So this is everything except prokaryotes. Otherwise, it would be the whole tree of life. And we're going to go through major parts of this with showing examples and talking about some things. But there's anything... is there anything weird about this tree that you notice right away? Just based on what you've learned about phylogenetic trees? Look at the ancestral lineage. What's happening there? It's splitting into 4 simultaneously, right? What do we call that? That's an example of what? What is it? Did you say it? That's right. It means it's not a mistake really so much as a lie. We don't have enough information yet. But what is it an example of? What do we call that? A polytomy, right? Which means multiple cutting. Instead of just splitting into 2, it splits into 3 or more simultaneously. Well, that doesn't actually happen, right? The odds against that happening are effectively infinite. Or the odds of it happening is almost 0, basically. So, this is a tree that was drawn because we don't have evidence to favor one of the possibilities over the others, like we were talking about in the phylogenies chapter. Also, this is from a book, and books... It takes so long to get a book to print that, you know, by the time you print something in a book, even a brand new book, it's likely the trees have been redrawn by the people who redraw these all the time. So this is probably redrawn in journal papers if you look at it that way. But we're gonna obey this tree in this book, and even though there's a polytomy, So we don't know exactly the relationship among these four major groups. There are these four major groups that we're going to look at. And those are the ones that are shown, that are labeled sideways at the edge. So the four major clades, and these, all of these groups are clades, right? True clades, because notice each one of them is defined by a node, that, and it includes everything that splits from that node. So these four are all true clades. But these four clades, as you see, for eukarya, are excavata, the sar clade, archaeplastida, and uniconta. Now these are huge groups because they make up an entire domain collectively, right? The sar clade by itself is especially enormous, and it's called the sar clade as an acronym. S-A-R is simply the acronym for the three major groups that make it up, which are the straminopiles, the alveolates, and the rhizarians. S, A, and R. All right, now, also notice that most of these terminal lineages, they're not really terminal, because if you looked at the details, they would branch many times. But each of these groups that are at the ends of the lineages shown here, most of them are highlighted in yellow. Not all, though, right? So what's the deal there? Well, this is why I waited to define protists for you. Protists used to be a formal group of organisms. Remember I told you that when I was first taught, and like in fifth grade classification, there were only five kingdoms at the time, and there were no domains. Kingdoms were the biggest things. One of those kingdoms was protista, or protists. So that was an official group. Well, it's no longer that way. We've learned better since then. We still use the word protist, but it no longer, it's not a kingdom, and it's not even monophyletic. Protists is an example of a paraphyletic taxon, and usually we like to avoid those, right? But we've been using the word protist for so long that we keep using it. So what is a protist, actually? Well, protists are listed here with yellow highlighting. Notice the only thing that isn't yellow are the animals, the fungi, and the plants. So the official, even though it's kind of an unofficial taxon, the official definition of a protist is any eukaryote that's not an animal, a plant, or a fungus. When you look at that on the tree, though, you can clearly see, since it includes only the yellow things, that that is paraphyletic, right? Because to be monophyletic, you have to include all the descendants that came from the ancestor that's common to everyone in the group. Well, the only thing that's common to everything in yellow is the ancestor to all eukarya, right? And therefore, you would have to include all the descendants, which would include animals, fungi, and plants. It's paraphyletic. But we still use it, even though that's kind of problematic. Well, even continuing on with that problematic nomenclature, there's also words like algae, which is the plural, by the way, of alga. Alga is, just means one organism. The plural is algae. Anyway, this is also kind of a catch-all word. It's not, algae is not a monophyletic taxon. So what are the algae? Well, we can see that some of them are called algae, and you can see that in this tree. Like, there are brown algae here, there are red algae here, there are green algae here. But also, there's plenty of algae that don't even have algae in their name, that are listed here but aren't listed as algae. So what is an alga? Well, it's also, like I said, paraphyletic. But what is meant by algae is photosynthetic protists. Okay, so I already told you what a protist is. A protist is, it has to be a eukaryote to be a protist, but it can't be an animal, plant, or a fungus. And so that whole group is the protist. Now, among those, there are some that are photosynthetic. If they are, then they're algae, by definition. The rest of the protists are not photosynthetic. So they are heterotrophs like we are, right? Okay, so that's the difference. Now remember, plants obviously are photosynthetic, but they're not algae because they're not protists, because they are plants. Protists are non-plants, non-animals, non-fungi. Okay, now these major groups were, another thing about algae is that you find algae in all four of these groups, basically. Even though, like I said before, some of them are called algae. But doesn't matter whether that's part of your name or not, you're an alga if you're a photosynthetic protist. And so there are examples of that in all the four of these clades. Further evidence that algae is really truly a paraphyletic taxon. We're going to look at examples of these, though. I think they go in order as we look at the slides from top to bottom. Now remember, the order here does not matter because you can swivel any node. There's no importance to excavata being at the top here, but that's the order that we're going to look at the examples in. So excavata get their name. We're on slide 10 now, and this is an example of an excavate or a member of excavata. They get their name because many of the species somewhere on the cell have a part of the surface that looks like it's been dug out or excavated. So we call them excavates. It's not so obvious on some species, but that's why the group is called that. And excavates include many unicellular protists that are parasites. Like this one, for instance, is a parasite of humans. Causes a sexually transmitted disease, which is pretty common in humans. And so that's a parasitic lifestyle. Others are photosynthetic, which is a totally different way of living, but they're still excavates. And we see an example of that in 11. This is a euglean. I, by the way, occasionally will go back to slide 9 just to show you where we are on the tree. Excavata at the top includes euglenas and parabasalids, notice. Those are the two examples we just looked at. That one that causes the sexually transmitted disorder is a parabasalid. The euglenid, obviously, is a euglenozoan. And slide 12, this is another one, excavate that lives a parasitic lifestyle. Once again, parasites of humans. Now, the red ones are not the excavates. The red ones are normal human red blood cells. But the violet-colored ones that are undulating along are the ones that are excavates and cause sleeping sickness in humans, which can cause the big sleep. 13. Now we're looking at examples in the next major clade. Shown on the tree, which was, remember, the SAR clade, the S-A-R clade. And the S of that, remember, stands for straminopiles. Let me just show you back on the tree that straminopiles includes brown algae. So this is straminopiles. Includes brown algae and diatoms. Well, we were looking at a diatom in slide 13. Diatoms are ocean-dwelling straminopiles that are algae. So not only are they protists, but they are photosynthetic. And that's really important ecologically because there's so many of them that they contribute to photosynthesis globally and produce oxygen, obviously, because of that. Now, this picture looks like it's fake. It looks like it's just computer-generated. It is computer-colorized, but this ornate shape that kind of looks like a decorative case is exactly how diatoms are. They are very elaborate. Now, this is not the cell itself. This is a glass case with a bottom and a lid that fits right over it. You can see that. Made out of silicon dioxide or glass that the cell that lives inside it produces. And that's why it's perforated so that it can still continue to live. But that glass case can withstand, and these are microscopic. So it's not only that elaborate, but it's invisibly elaborate. Anyway, these glass cases, which are called tests, just another name for a case, can withstand a hell of a lot of force, of jaws, for instance. And so that was really a huge advantage for them. They are nice to look at under microscopes because since they are photosynthetic, they are naturally colored. If you look at, you might have done, in 181, you might have done a cheek smear where you look at your own cells. Your own cells are pretty transparent because they're not photosynthetic. They don't have pigments in them, most of them. But plant cells or algal cells will have color in them naturally because of photosynthesis. That not only makes them nice to look at, but they have a huge variety of geometric shapes. They don't look like something that's actually real in biology. They look like they've been computer generated. So they're not all shaped like this. There's a huge variety. Anyway, they are straminopiles, part of the S of SAR. And remember that along with diatoms in the straminopiles are the brown algae. We're looking at a brown alga here in 14. Now, obviously, brown algae are algae. Well, so were diatoms, even though that's not in their name. But the special thing about brown algae is that they are, well, some of the species of brown algae are by far the largest algae. Now, there's alga simply means photosynthetic prokaryote, like I said. There are some unicellular photosynthetic protists. So they're still algae, right, because they're photosynthetic. But there are also multicellular algae. And those are the ones that tend to have algae in their name, like brown algae. Well, brown algae, compared to even the other multicellular algae, can be enormous. They can be the size of trees living in the ocean. This one, by the way, looks a lot like a tree, but importantly, it is not a plant, right? It's an alga. And the things that its resemblance to a plant is just superficial. It's not because it's related to a plant. These things that look like roots are not roots. They are holdfasts. A true root for a true vascular plant is partially to hold it in place, which is what this holdfast is for. But a true plant's roots is a vascular thing that brings in water from the soil. That's not what's happening here. It lives underwater. It doesn't have to get water from soil. But it holds it in place. And this thing that looks like a stem, you might be tempted to call it a stem by analogy with a plant, is a stipe. The things that look like leaves are blades, actually. Now, brown algae obviously are named for their color. Different algae have different colors of pigment. But pigments, in general, are simply things that absorb light. That's what a definition in chemistry is of a pigment. That's a type of molecule that's able to absorb humanly visible light. Well, the plant or the alga does not care at all about humanly visible. It's just a coincidence that the same kind of light that interacts with our eyes is also interacts with pigments that are important for photosynthesis. So chlorophyll is what makes plants green. There are some algae that are green, but not all photosynthetic pigments are green. Some are brown, like you see, or red. Or 15, this is an alveolate, just a kind of a generalized cartoon version of an alveolate. Well, at least the one on the right is. Let me quickly go back to the tree to show you where we are. Alveolates is the A of SAR. So it includes dinoflagellates, apocomplexans, and ciliates. But the name alveolates comes from the fact that many of the members of this group have somewhere in their cells little bag-like structures called alveoli, which is what that's the plural of alveolus. And alveolus means little bag. It's the same word that's used for the tiny bag-like endings of your bronchioles in your lungs. Your lungs is not a huge bag. That wouldn't work. There wouldn't be enough surface area, right? Instead, it's thousands and thousands of tiny alveoli. Anyway, it's the same word. Now, they don't all have them that look like this, but that's what the group is named for. And alveolates, just like the other major groups we have, include some algae. So there are photosynthetic alveolates. There are some that are parasitic as well. This one is a flagellated one, which is why dinoflagellates are called that. Not all cells have a flagellum, but that's what the flagellate part of the word comes from. Dinoflagellates are also really important ecologically for their photosynthesis, and they can enormously rise in population and then crash in populations, leading to red tide and things like this in the ocean. There's so many of them available, that occur. 17, you can probably guess that this thing is a ciliate. Ciliates are named for the fact that they have cilia on them, right? Which literally means hairs, even though they're not true hairs. This is something you are likely to see if you just sample pond water around here and look at which we do in here. If you just look at a sample of pond water, you're likely to come across a paramecium, which is what this is. The point, though, is it's an example of a ciliate. Now, ciliates don't have to be. I think there are photosynthetic ciliates, but this one is not. This paramecium uses these cilia basically to create currents in the water that will sweep food, little particles of food, toward this oral groove, which is basically its mouth. Here we have an apicomplexan that actually it doesn't matter what group this belongs to. The point here is that this cell has this strange green thing in it, which is called a chromatophore. Now, you might guess that it's a chloroplast, and it actually is, or at least it's serving the same function. It doesn't really look like a chloroplast, though. In almost all the huge variety of eukaryotic photosynthetic organisms, including plants and algae, the thing they have in common is that they have chloroplasts. And chloroplasts are very similar to each other, even in widely different kinds of photosynthetic eukaryotes. Here we have one, though, this chromatophore, that is not shaped anything like a normal chloroplast. And when you get down to studying it at molecular detail, it looks like it might be an example of the same thing happening twice. Another example of endosymbiosis independent from the one that created the first chloroplasts. It just happened again, kind of like convergent. It is convergent evolution. It does perform the same function, though. It's photosynthesis. Okay, now we're in slide 19. We're into the red algae. Let me go back and show you where we are on the tree. Red algae are part of Archaeplastida. That's the third major clade. And red algae, notice, is a true clade, right? Green algae, which are also in Archaeplastida, green algae is not a true clade because it includes the chlorophytes and the charophytes, which have this as an ancestor, but land plants are excluded, so that's not a true clade. You see what I'm saying there? Anyway, the green algae and the red algae make up the protist part of Archaeplastida. Also in there, though, importantly, are all plants. Plants itself is a clade, But when you throw together all plants plus red algae plus green algae, that makes up the overall archaeoplastid clade of eukaryotes.
So because it's not a part of the algae, it doesn't make it like one unit, one section?
Well, archaeoplastida itself is a clade, because this whole group that includes all four of these listed, those are defined by this ancestor, right? And it's a true clade or a monophyletic taxon because it includes all of those descendants. Archaeoplastida does. But the group that we call green algae, which is defined by this ancestor, does not include all the descendants of that ancestor. Otherwise, it would include land plants as well. And that's why it's paraphyletic. But what I was saying is that Archaeoplastida includes three major groups of photosynthetic eukaryotes: green algae, red algae, and all the plants. Also, while we're at it, let me show you that land plants have as a sister taxon one of the two major types of green algae. There's two major groups of green algae: chlorophytes and charophytes. It's the charophytes that are the sister taxon to land plants. You can see that from this tree, but we'll spend a lot of time on land plants. We're going to do an entire unit on land plants. Anyway, back to the example slides, which is slide 19. Red algae are obviously algae, and therefore obviously photosynthetic. They have a different color once again because they use different pigments. Why would you have different colored pigments, by the way? Well, it depends on where you live. Red algae, let me start over with using plants as a familiar example. Or green algae, they're both green. Why do they look green to us, though? Why?
The light.
Well, yes, but what about the light? Pigments do what, by definition? They absorb light. So light, white light, which is the combination of all colors, strikes the plant or the green alga. It does a good job of absorbing most of that light, but not all of it. It absorbs red light and blue light very well, and that's what drives photosynthesis. So when it absorbs that light does not get reflected to our eyes. It doesn't absorb green well, though, which is why if you try to grow a plant in just green light, it's going to die. So that green light is the only light that makes it back to our eyes after it reflects off the plant or the alga, and that's why they look green to us. Similarly, a red alga looks red to us because it doesn't absorb red well. It absorbs green and blue well, especially blue. Now, if you look at the spectrum of electromagnetic radiation, the Roy G. Biv, there's red is at one end, blue is at the other end. Blue is the more energetic light. Red is less energetic. And that matters when it comes to refracting. When light goes from one medium to a medium of different density, like it does when it goes from air to the surface of the water. Same thing that's happening if you wear glasses. You're going from air to a much denser lens. There's bending or refraction of that light. And how much bending occurs, meaning the angle it makes, depends on the frequency or the color or the color. Well, blue light bends different at a different angle compared to red light, and being more energetic, it penetrates deeper into the ocean, which is why the ocean looks blue, basically. The point here is that if you were an alga that lived deep, you wouldn't want to have a pigment that can only absorb red light, because red light doesn't make it as deep. Blue light does. So the pigment that absorbs blue well, but does not absorb red and doesn't have to because red light doesn't make it down there, looks red to us because it reflects that light. That's why you have different pigment colors. Anyway, we know it as sushi wrappers, and for other reasons. Slide 20 this thing might look like a plant to you, it's not a plant. I said a little bit ago that plants have as a sister taxon one of the types of green algae. Well, this isn't even that kind of algae. These are chlorophyte algae, as you see. One of the two major types of green algae, but not the one that is more related to plants. The one that's more related to plants are the charophytes. And we'll talk about that in the plants chapter. These ones, though, just superficially look like plants. They are true green algae, though, photosynthesizing with their own green pigment. It's the same pigment, though. It's still chlorophyll, which is why it makes them look so much like plants. Now to 21. Well, this is the only example of the clade that we belong to within Eukarya. I think it's the only example. So what is the clade, the big super clade that we belong to? Of the four that make up Eukarya, which one are we members of? The hint is it's the only one we haven't talked about yet. It's Unikanta, which is the one that's on the bottom of the tree as it's drawn. By the way, let me just show you something else about Unikanta. Obviously, we are animals, right? So all animals are in Unikanta. But we're just one of several things that are in Unikanta. All the fungi are also in Unikanta. So the three major large multicellular eukaryote groups, which are the animals, the plants, and the fungi, two of those are in Unikanta. And we'll be talking more about this later in a different chapter, but you can see already that animals and fungi are more closely related to each other than either of them is related to plants. But anyway, along with us animals and the fungi in Unikanta, there are some protists as well. The yellow ones are all protists, of course, including amoebozoans that get their name. This is another one of these kind of loose words. Not amoebozoans, but amoeba. Now, you've probably heard of amoebas, right? You might have looked at amoebas under a microscope. Maybe not, but an amoeba is not a particular species or anything. It's not a clade either. It's another one of these loose paraphyletic words like alga and protist. An amoeba is what we call anything that has cells that move by pseudopodal locomotion. Pseudopodal means having false feet. Pseudo means false, pod means foot. What these pseudopoda are just short-lived. They're not a permanent structure. A cell will just squeeze part of itself out, make a little out-pocketing that acts like a little foot. It'll attach to a surface, then it'll drag the rest of the cell forward, and that pseudopoda will disappear. Not all cells do this. They're continuously changing shape, but ones that do, we call those amoebas. Whatever group they are in, they're not just in Unikanta. So they're spread out all over everywhere else. Okay, but anyway, I'm not going to give you humans or any other animal as an example of Unikanta. I'm giving you one of the other ones in slide 21 simply because we're going to have a whole chapter dedicated to just animals. This example is slime molds. Here you see a picture of a slime mold. These are interesting creatures from our point of view. They seem really weird because they really make you question what the definition of... Well, they really don't make you question the definitions of unicellularity and multicellularity. It's just that they happen to be both. It depends on when you catch them in their life cycle. So you can see, first of all, that they can live an asexual life cycle or a sexual life cycle, which is true for other groups as well, like plants can do this and a lot of protists can do it. But anyway, let's start where the two rings combined here, right in the middle, where you have these amoebas. You can see that they don't have a definite shape by definition of being an amoeba. But when they're in this part of the life cycle, notice that they are listed as N. What does N mean in genetics? N is what number? Right, but what about the chromosomes? It has to do with ploidy. N is the haploid number. So if a cell is listed as N, that means it's a haploid cell. But what does that mean? It means that it has only one of each kind of chromosome, however many different kinds there are. Right? There are N different kinds, but there's only one of each of those N's in a haploid cell. Like our own gametes, right? Sperm and egg are haploid, but the cells that make up our bodies are diploid, which would be denoted as 2N. Anyway, these are haploid solitary amoebas. Each individual cell is its own organism. So that is clearly a unicellular lifestyle, right? But that's only part of the lifestyle, like I was saying. If food is plentiful, they'll just go around eating things and not caring what the other amoebas are doing, because they're all individuals. But when times are good and food is plentiful, they will enter into a sexual life cycle where there will be fusion of gametes, fusion of two haploid cells to produce a diploid cell, just like you started out as a zygote, right? That's the essence of sex. And that will produce more haploid amoebas. It's reproduction, but it's sexual reproduction, so it mixes up the genes. All right. Now, if eventually the environment changes, food runs out or whatever, then they are going to undergo a drastic change in lifestyle. What were free-living individual amoebas will now collect into a huge mass, and this is why they're called slime molds. This is a mass of them. Kind of looks superficially like an animal. It doesn't have any definite shape. It can be just like a sheet of snot-looking stuff, but it writhes along the forest floor and moves out of there to where hopefully conditions will be better. But it does this as clearly a multicellular individual at that point, because it's cooperation between all of these individual cells that are massed together. Then, when the destination is reached, some of those cells in this huge mass will form a huge stalk-like sprout out of the top. Most of them will dry up and die, and the ones that are in this bulb-like exterior will basically hatch what are called fruiting bodies that will give rise to spores, haploid spores. This is all the asexual part that will then become free-living amoebas again, and hopefully the conditions will be better after that. And if not, then they will do the same thing and find another place. But it's a pretty strange thing. We're not used to seeing things move if they don't have clearly defined body parts, like a head or something. So it's very similar to like the 50s movie, The Blob, only not as big. Okay, slide 22. The cartoon represents here an ecosystem. And this one happens to be a marine ecosystem because it's in salt water, in the ocean. Whatever ecosystem you have, though, and we'll talk more about this in the ecology unit at the end, the base of any ecosystem, sustaining the whole ecosystem, there has to be producers. Now, what's another word that you know that means producers? Producers are also known as what? Producers are called producers because they're able to produce their own food. And what kind of organisms can do that? What's the other word? Autotrophs, exactly. So autotrophs or producers are at the base and support any ecosystem, not just marine ones. The reason that this is in this chapter, even though this is not an ecology chapter, is that while we're studying protists, it's important to mention that along with various prokaryotic producers, the cyanobacteria are the prokaryotic producers. They are photosynthetic bacteria, and they are really important producers in the ocean. But there are also really important protistin producers, namely the unicellular algae, well, actually unicellular and multicellular, but the unicellular algae that are pictured here in cartoon form are really important because it's easy for them. They are plankton. Plankton is a general word that simply means small stuff that is so small it easily floats in the water. Doesn't really sink easily. And so plankton, which is not, you know, it's a mixture of different species, it easily gets eaten by things that are slightly larger than it. But those slightly larger things that eat it are consumers. And they wouldn't exist without the producers there to feed them. Well, similarly, the things that eat those consumers are themselves consumers, even bigger, and they're all dependent on, eventually, the producers at the base. That's why they're so important. None of us would exist without producers. None of us consumers, which all animals are, would exist without producers. And that brings us to one of many bad news slides in this course. We've already had a couple. The extinction ones were bad news. Slide 23 is a graph having to do with just the oceans, not the land masses here. The colored part of the globe here is the ocean. And even though it's all really one ocean, because it's all connected, we give different regions of it different names, which are shown in the graph here. The bad news aspect of this is the results. Notice that in almost all places in the ocean, just these couple exceptions, a study done by satellites that can measure how much greenness there is, basically, can measure how much chlorophyll there is and therefore have a gauge of how many producers are there living healthy lives. It's all decreased. Almost all of it has decreased, which is why it's bad news. If you start interfering with the producers, causing them to go extinct, certainly the consumers are going to go extinct because of that. That, of course, includes us. Slide 24. You don't really, probably can't tell much from this figure, but we're looking at an extreme close-up of a protist, and that's why it's in this chapter, that lives its whole... This is another example of an endosymbiotic relationship, like the flashlight fish. What we're looking at here, though, is a microscopic protist that lives inside the digestive tract of termites. Now, what are termites infamous for? Eating what? Wood. And they're infamous for eating houses. It's not that they prefer houses, but houses have a lot of wood in them. They just want to eat wood. That's a surprising thing that they want to eat wood, though. Even though, well, wood is almost entirely cellulose. And cellulose is a polymer. It's a large polysaccharide, right? Made by hooking together a bunch of monosaccharides. It's not only a polymer, though. It's a polymer made up of thousands and thousands of the same kind of monomer, which is what, specifically? What's the monosaccharide type that is strung together to make cellulose? No idea? Give me and just guess. What is an example of a monosaccharide? An important one. Well, what is a monosaccharide then? This is not 181 stuff, that 182 stuff. This is 181 stuff. What are monosaccharides, just in general? What are they? Sugars, simple sugars. And what's the most important one in terms of fuel? What's the master fuel for all cells? What is it? Well, carbohydrates is just another name for sugars. There are small ones that we call monosaccharides. There are big carbohydrates that we call polysaccharides. But the ones that can be used directly for fuel have to be monosaccharides. What is the most important one of those? Not just in our own cells, in all cells. Glucose. And cellulose, which is a huge polysaccharide, is made by stringing together a thousands and thousands of glucoses. So, the reason I'm saying this is that a cellulose molecule, like you have in wood or paper, it's chock full of fuel in the form of glucose. But we can't use any of that fuel, we as animals, because we don't have the genes to code for the right kind of proteins that would act as enzymes to break the cellulose apart into individual glucoses. If we did, then we could eat paper and get nutrition from it. Well, a termite is a fellow animal. It also doesn't have the right enzymes. But the reason that it's able to get away with it and get nutrition from the wood it eats is that it has this endosymbiotic protist living in its digestive tract that's always there, and it's continuously being fed by the termite. When the termite eats the wood, that's giving a continuous food supply to the microscopic protist that digests the cellulose for its own sake. It's not doing that for the termite. It's doing it for its own life. But it does it so well that there's plenty of cellulose freed up for the termite to use. It's another just important example of ecological interactions between protists and other organisms, which is why it's in this chapter. Well, 25 is another example of important ecological interactions, but this, in this case, it involves humans, and not positively. This is another example of a symbiotic relationship, but symbiosis does not have to mean that everyone benefits. When both species in a symbiotic relationship benefit, that's called mutualism. There's mutual benefit. But parasitism is also symbiotic. It's a close relationship between two organisms. One benefits and the other gets harmed, though. And so part of the ecological importance of some of these protists is that many of them are important parasites for various kinds of other eukaryotes, including humans. This one is actually involves three different species, two different host species. Any given parasite has to have a host, right? The species in which it lives or on which it lives. It relies on the host for whatever reason. Well, some of these parasites, including this one, have really, really complex parasite-host relationships involving multiple hosts that have to be just the right kind of hosts. In this case, the two hosts are a kind of mosquito. It has to be the right kind of mosquito that it lives half of its lifetime in, or half of the life cycle, I should say, and humans specifically, not just any animal, but humans. And the entire life cycle of this parasite is spent in one of those two hosts or the other. It's never free living on its own. So we can start the cycle here up at the top where the guy here is being bitten by the mosquito. Well, that mosquito is already carrying this parasite in it. All right? So when the mosquito bites the human to get its blood, it injects saliva into the human, which includes some cells of this parasite. Well, those cells, which are denoted by these little bluish things, this is the same one that we looked at before, the sleeping sickness one, the trypanosomes. Anyway, once they're in the human bloodstream, they will travel to the liver and invade the cells of the liver, which are hepatocytes. So this is just one liver cell, the brown thing, and they drastically multiply inside the liver cells, producing what are called merozoites. Notice they are haploid. And that will burst the liver cells. This is why it's so damaging to humans. You don't want your liver damaged, because it does a hell of a lot of important things. When those merozoites explode out of the dead liver cells, they take up residence in the bloodstream again and start infecting red blood cells that are part of the bloodstream. And once they're inside there, they basically do the same thing, but they produce a different kind of cell called gametocytes, which burst out of now dead red blood cells. And that's the part that they have to have a human for. Then another mosquito comes along later and bites the same dude, but this time it picks up, rather than delivering things to the human, it picks up the gametocytes that have developed in the human. And then inside, the rest of this is fully inside the mosquito for the rest of its life cycle. Inside, those gametocytes turn into gametes. Gametes, as you already know, can then fuse. The two different kinds of gametes can fuse in a fertilization event. That's the sexual part of the life cycle, to produce a zygote, just like you started at. But this is a zygote of a brand new one of these parasites inside the body of a mosquito. Well, it immediately undergoes meiosis to become haploid cells again, and those ones are the sporozoites that get then delivered to another human after it's bit by that same mosquito. And those are absolute requirements. If you don't have the mosquito and the human, this thing can't live. That is the end of the chapter. But not the end of the night, of course. We still have a laboratory.